This is Tim Mantuani, and you're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James.
Welcome to the Petapixel Photography Podcast, episode 49. Ever wondered why some Canon lenses are white? In this episode, We explain why this is. Pentax finally enters the full-frame DSLR market. But is it too late? The world's most powerful ND filter is coming, and we discuss why you need one. The World Press Photo Award winners have been announced, and the cameras used might surprise some. A new storage technology may outlast the entire human race. All that and more in episode 49 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Thank you so much, Tim, for opening the show. I greatly appreciate it. Tim Mantuani is a photographer's photographer. You may remember his book, Behind Photographs, Archiving Photographic Legends, which documents photographers and their most memorable images, as well as the incredible work he's done for clients such as Sports Illustrated, Newsweek, ESPN, and countless advertising gigs from EA Sports to Coca-Cola. He attended the Brooks Institute of Photography, worked under the late, great Dean Collins, and is a truly inspiring photographer. To be blown away by his amazing work, check him out at mantuani.com. That's M-A-N-T-O-A-N-I.com. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here in episode 49 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We appreciate you all so much, and thank you for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever else you listen to us. And as always, we greatly appreciate you telling your friends and everyone else on social media or wherever. We thank you so much for that. Okay, with that, I'm your host, Sharky James. Let's hit it. Have you ever wondered why some Canon lenses are white rather than black, like the majority of the other lenses that they have, and their counterparts at Nikon and Sony, etc.? Many people are going to tell you that this is all about marketing. That Canon wants you to see these white lenses, and they're actually more like a beige or off-white putty kind of color, and think about their brand. But that's just not true. Sure, that's a side benefit, but the real reason has to do with heat more than anything else. As you may know, I was a photojournalist for many years, in Arizona no less, and it gets incredibly hot there, even up in the mountains. I've shot both Nikon and Canon in that heat, and I can tell you that the black lenses get hotter, and that is not ideal at all. From the classic 70-200mm f2.8 on up to the 300, the 400, and the super telephotos that you see mostly used by sports and wildlife shooters, usually outdoors and often with the sun beating down on them, having these lighter colored lenses are huge, huge help. Well, Canon Europe recently confirmed this yet again, because they've done it before, by saying this on their website, quote, "Lenses contain glass elements. These expand with heat. This is not usually a problem with compact lenses. The amount of expansion is small, but larger lenses contain large elements, and here expansion can bring a lens close to the limits of design tolerances. A white surface reflects sunlight, helping to keep the lens cooler," end quote. You know, over the years, I've talked to Canon reps, a former Canon engineer, as well as others in the industry, and they've all confirmed that while the white helps the lenses stand out, they look great on TV, they look great in photos, and that's awesome from a branding standpoint, it actually came about as a method of reducing heat. You know, spend hours in the sun as I have shooting a track meet, and you'll notice changes to your lens, especially if they're black. You know, it'd also be nice if they made those zoom and focus rings white as well, because they're made of rubber. And when you're out there in the heat, they become so loose and so distorted, I've actually had to have them replaced before, and that is just crazy. Now, according to Canon Japan, the white lenses first appeared on Canon lenses way back in 1976 with the FD600mm f4.5 and the 800mm f5.6. Canon also points out that many of its black lenses have a heat-related feature that many don't know about. If you're in extreme heat and you notice that your lens allows you to focus past its infinity mark, what we refer to as over-focusing, that's actually to allow the lens to expand while shooting in hot conditions. After this heat expansion, infinity focusing will be closer to the end of where the ring stops, so keep an eye out for that. So now you know, and knowing is half the battle. Okay, a few of you out there are going to get that reference. Tweet at me if you do. I'm at LensShark. Anyway, I think it's worth noting that Nikon and other lenses from other manufacturers, Sigma, Sony, Tamron, Tokina, whatever, seem to operate just fine in the same conditions, and they're mostly all black. They definitely get hotter, though. There's no doubt about it. Black absorbs heat. Lighter colors reflect heat. That's just simple physics, right? It's also worth noting that many photographers seem to choose Canon from the start due to those white L-series lenses, even if they can't afford them at the time. You know, they're aspirational, something to work toward. It's like owning the brand new Canon 80D, but you really want that 1DX Mark II. You can't afford it right now. It's like $5,000 more expensive, but it's something that you aspire to having. So you get into the Canon system because you want something like that, and maybe it's those white L lenses that attract you. And of course, these lenses won't make you a better photographer. They just won't. The larger these lenses are particularly challenging to operate. You know, they're not a magic bullet to amazing sports photos, such as those by Damien Strohmeyer, Peter Reed Miller, etc. They're all tools, and some of these tools are a lot harder to operate than you would think. But all things being equal, if you're shooting in extreme heat a lot, a white lens, of course, is going to help to cool things down, just as you'll stay cooler if you wear lighter clothing. Next. Well, it's now official. Pentax has entered the full-frame market with the new Pentax K1, a camera the company says, quote, offers innovations not available in any other DSLR, end quote. But is it a little too late to the game? I mean, we've had full-frame DSLRs for a long, long time now, right? Well, on Wednesday, February 17th, 2016, Ricoh-owned Pentax announced their entry into the market with a camera that sports a 36.4-megapixel CMOS sensor, which omits the anti-aliasing filter to offer maximum sharpness and instead offers the ability to help eliminate the moiré effect in your photos via an AA filter simulator instead. That's pretty interesting. It's doing it in software. You know, personally, I think that everyone should ditch that anti-aliasing filter. I think we've moved well past that by now. We want sharper results. And for the five people out there actually shooting finely woven patterns, they can deal with that a different way. The rest of us, we want tack sharp results. So this is a good move here. The K1's ISO can go up to the digital snowstorm known as 204,800, which no one shoots at. And the new Prime 4 imaging engine allows this body to capture 14-bit raw photos. It offers a newly refined SR2 shake reduction system with 5-axis stabilization. Their pixel shift resolution system can capture super resolution photos by shooting, quote, 4 images of the same scene by shifting the image sensor by a single pixel for each image, then synthesizes them into a single composite image, end quote. Now, I'm thinking that you're only going to bust this out when you're locked down on a tripod and nothing is moving in your scene. So maybe landscapes. Landscapes on a very still, non-windy day, right? As for autofocus, it boasts a new SafeFox 12 AF system that has 33 AF points, 25 of which are the more accurate cross-type variety. The body is fairly compact and rugged as it's weather-sealed, dust-proof, and cold-proof thanks to 87 sealing points, making this a camera that on paper at least should be able to handle the elements nicely. On the back is a flexible tilt screen with actuator struts that allow you to position it to angles not possible with the screens on most cameras on the market today. It's really odd looking, you know, think pistons or shock absorbers and you kind of have the idea of what these things look like. It also seems a little awkward to use, and I wonder just how durable it's going to be. It's said to be fairly strong, but you just never know when you're contorting this thing every which way. Now, ergonomically, the Pentax K1 seems a little bit cramped to me. The AF and AEL buttons on the back seem to be a little bit too far to the right for my liking. You know, if you're a back button autofocus shooter like me, and your thumb is on that AF button for long periods of time, I think your hand is going to be hating you in short order. It would have been nice to see them move it a little bit more to the left, actually a lot more to the left, because if you've got huge hands, even if you don't have huge hands, I think that's going to be really uncomfortable. Another first that this camera has in a DSLR is the special Operation Assist lights on the body. These are small white LEDs that help you work the camera's controls while shooting in low light. I think that's going to be a huge help for a lot of people. This may not seem like a big deal until you need to do things like, oh, I don't know, change lenses, swap memory cards, and use the interface on the back of the camera when it's pretty darn dark outside. Sure, you could use a flashlight, but that's one more thing that you have to bring with you, fumble with, etc. So the inclusion of these OALs, pretty darn cool, I think. Now, if you're moving up to the K1 from a crop sensor system, there's a crop mode that lets you shoot APS-C size photos regardless of what lens you're using. You know, one of the cool things about the K1 is it has a dial on top, not just for PASM, auto, and U through 5 modes, which is pretty cool, by the way. It has another dial that has Wi-Fi, crop, grid, HDR, ISO, and other things on it, so you can quickly get into those modes without having to drill through a billion menu system items. That is cool. This camera also features a nearly 100% viewfinder, Wi-Fi, GPS, a dust removal feature, HDR mode, dual SD card slots, 1080p video at 30 frames per second, and 4.4 frames per second continuous shooting. Now, it should go without saying that this is not a sports body, of course, not even close. Not with that few frames per second and those many megapixels, right? This is clearly a body destined more for landscape photographers and those who are doing portraiture. Along with the K1, there are a number of lenses available, including a 15-30mm f2.8 and a 28-105mm f3.5-5.6 that were just announced. And of course, a huge feature of this body is all those people out there that have Pentax lenses from across the decades can use them with this camera. You know, if you've got Pentax lenses from a 35mm body like the K1000 from decades ago, those were full frame. So you can use those with this body. Now, as for how much resolution they resolve, I don't know. Can they resolve all 36.4 megapixels? Don't know. We'll see. That's a real important consideration when buying into a camera system. For instance, look at Canon's 5DS and 5DSR. 50-something megapixels, 56, 52, whatever it is. A huge amount of megapixels. Yet most of Canon's lenses don't resolve anywhere near 50 or whatever megapixels that it is. So that's a bit of a problem. What Ricoh Pentax is also doing is making an adapter to use your Pentax 6-4-5 medium format lenses on this camera as well. So if you have a bunch of those lying around, or you also shoot in medium format, and for some reason you want this camera because the medium format is just too cool, and so you want to dumb things down a little bit, I don't know, you can adapt those lenses to this camera. I don't think many people are going to be doing that, but you can. So there's that. Now, the Pentax K1 will be available sometime in April 2016 for about $1,800 US. That's a good chunk of change. I think that's fair for what you're getting here, though. While I find this to be an interesting camera with some really cool features, it's not really a particularly exciting camera now, is it? I don't think many people are going to be jumping ship from Canon or Nikon to get into this Pentax system. It's just not that compelling to me. But if you have old Pentax lenses and you haven't bought into either system yet, and you want to try something new, the Pentax K1 might be something worth looking into. It's not going to be a horrible camera. It looks to be a decent camera. You know, we're going to see where the image quality is versus other cameras out there once these things are in the wild. But in the meantime, I think it's worth looking into. According to Southern California startup Aurora Aperture, their newly announced Power XND 2000 is the world's most powerful ND filter with a range of 4 to 11 stops of neutral density. If you've never used one before, an ND filter is one of the two types of filters that I actually recommend, the other being a circular polarizer. Everything else, mostly useless. Especially protective, and I'm doing air quotes here, UV filters. Don't get me started on those again. However, with a variable ND filter, you're able to dial in just how much you'd like to darken your exposure by, and that is greatly helpful in so many circumstances. Now, why would you want to do that when we so often complain about not having enough light or not having enough high ISO available to us? There are a number of good reasons. A couple of my favorites is to get a slow enough exposure to get waterfalls and other moving water to have that silky smooth cotton candy effect. That's really cool and a great use for it. The other being absolutely obliterating most of the bright sunlight so I can turn day into night and light my subject as I wish. It works amazingly well. Especially if you want to shoot at f2.8. of their new filter, Aurora Aperture says, quote, "The Power XND 2000 has 11 stops, also known as ND2000, of light reduction capability, which has only been available with fixed neutral density ND filters until now," end quote. It has what you want in every filter, of course, and that is a slim profile. This one comes in at just 5.5 millimeters, so that's going to greatly reduce the chances of vignetting on wide-angle lenses. Now, I say reduce and not eliminate because it's going to depend on which wide-angle lens you use, of course. There's too many variables out there. In fact, the company says they've managed to make this be 45% thinner than other variable ND filters on the market. In other words, it's nearly half the size of the others, which is great, and I applaud that. But I can tell you from experience that you're for sure going to want to get yourself one of those filter removers because most of us tend to tighten our filters way too much, and then they're a pain to get off without one. So it looks kind of like a little, I don't know how to describe it, like a U-shaped kind of thin plastic or metal wrench kind of thing that you put around the filter and gently, so you don't scratch anything and break anything, twist it off. It's really easy. Aurora Aperture CEO Jinfu Chen says of their new filter, quote, "ND filters are popular among landscape photographers and videographers for reducing the amount of light. Variable ND filters are useful as they can replace multiple fixed ND filters. However, the variable ND filters in the market today typically have 6+ usable stops, whereas users often demand more stopping power, such as 10 or more stops. Our Power XND 2000 family of variable ND filters will be able to satisfy this requirement with additional benefits, such as superior image quality that rivals fixed ND filters, and slim frame profile to prevent vignetting in wide-angle lenses," end quote. These filters are made of aerospace-grade aluminum that's been treated for protection against corrosion, and the lubricant in the filters has an extended temperature range, allowing it to have smooth yet dampened rotation in all weather conditions. And that's key here. Anyone who uses a filter which rotates to dial in more ND, polarization, etc., knows that in low temps, it's often rough going. So we'll see how this one holds up. I'd love to get my hands on one at some point. It looks pretty cool. The Aurora Power XND 2000 will be available initially in 67, 72, 77, and 82 millimeter filter thread sizes, starting at $159 US. And they have plans for many of the other sizes, so you'll be covered. And of course, as with any filter, get the biggest size that you can, which will cover the filter thread size of the largest lens that you have. And then get a slim step-down ring for a few bucks. Will that increase the chance of vignetting? Yes. Will it save you hundreds of dollars by not having to buy more of these filters for each of your lenses? Yes. So there's that. Aurora Aperture is planning to launch the filters through a Kickstarter campaign toward the end of February 2016 and says that shipments to the general public will begin sometime later in the summer of 2016. So stay tuned. This year's winners of World Press Photo's Best News Photos of 2015 have been announced, and the top photo, titled Hope for a New Life, captured by Australian photographer Warren Richardson, shows a baby being passed through a fence of razor wire at the Hungarian-Serbian border on August 28, 2015. Of the photo, here's what Richardson had to say about it and how it came about. Quote, "I camped with the refugees for about 5 days on the border. A group of about 200 people arrived, and they moved under the trees along the fence line. They sent women and children, then fathers and elderly men first. I must have been with this crew for about 5 hours, and we played cat and mouse with the police the whole night. I was exhausted by the time I took the picture. It was around 3 o'clock in the morning, and you can't use a flash while the police are trying to find these people because I would just give them away. So I had to use moonlight alone," end quote. A total of 82,951 photos were entered into the contest by some 5,775 photographers from 128 countries around the world. And this was the first year the prestigious photo contest was governed by its newly drafted code of ethics. Now, you might remember that a year ago, 20% of entrants had to be disqualified due to post-processing of the images that fell outside of WPP's guidelines. For his big win, Richardson will receive 10,000 euros, that's roughly $11,000 US as I record this, a Canon 1DX Mark II DSLR, that's pretty sweet, and lens kit from Canon. The winning photos will be exhibited in 100 cities in 45 countries around the world next year and will be viewed by an estimated 3.5 million people worldwide. In case you're wondering, Richardson captured the winning photo with an older Canon 5D Mark II and a fast 24mm f1.4 at ISO 6400. So anyone who tells you need the latest and greatest, not true. He doesn't even have a 5D Mark III. He's got the one previous to it, and he still won the top prize. Technique over gear, like I say all the time. Gear's great to have, but if you know what you're doing, you can win the top prize from World Press Photo. And he proved it. Now, the photo isn't tack sharp, and in fact, it looks like it may have been shot decades ago, but it doesn't matter. It's a powerful image nonetheless. You know, if he had shot it with that new flagship camera that Canon has, the 1DX Mark II, he easily could have shot that at an ISO a couple of stops higher, and it would have been just amazing. More amazing, I should say. And that's what we're getting as technology advances. Imagine images that we're going to be seeing from these contest winners in just 10 years' time. You know, we're in for some really amazing things. The Spanish website Casa Beste analyzed the EXIF data in all the winning photos and found some interesting things. And that is, once again, Canon came out on top. Of the 45 photos, 15 of them were captured with the 5D Mark III, and 6 were shot with the Canon 1DX. Of the Nikon cameras used, the D810 was used the most, with 4 photographers having used that body. Now, when you break it down by brand, 28 of the cameras used were Canon, and just 12 were Nikon. I think that's pretty surprising, because there are amazing bodies available from both of those companies, but for some reason, they're mostly Canon that are winning these awards. I don't get it. And only one was shot using a Sony. Now, when it comes to photojournalism, the mirrorless systems just aren't there yet. As much as I love them, they just aren't. And part of it is lens selection, although Sony recently upped their game with those G Master F2.8 zooms and that awesome 85mm F1.4. And also another part of it, I think, is durability. The mirrorless bodies thus far just aren't as ruggedly built as their DSLR counterparts. If Sony and the others start bulking up their bodies, though, then you've got something that more resembles a DSLR, and I think that's going to turn off a lot of people, because a lot of people have been going to mirrorless because they wanted something smaller and lighter, right? However, they're creeping up in that direction, but it's going to be slow going, and that's by design, of course. But don't be surprised if in 5 years' time, Sony mirrorless cameras look a whole lot like DSLRs. They just don't have a mirror inside. You know, I don't think Sony cares, though. They're doing quite well selling these bodies hand over fist, the way they look now, not all bulked up and DSLR-like, so I don't think they really care. And also, I don't think they particularly care about the ever-shrinking photojournalism market. Think about it. That's really not who they're targeting these cameras at. If you're a photojournalist, you're more than likely going to be going with a Canon or a Nikon. That's just how it is. Now, if you want to see a complete list of cameras used by this year's winners, hit the show notes for episode 49 at petapixel.com/podcast. As we all know, one of the tough things about backing up your photos to hard drives is that even if you're great about doing that and make sure that everything is up to date, eventually your hard drive will fail. They all do. Disk rot and data rot are a real thing, and they need to be planned for. But what if you'd like to ensure that your photos outlive not only you, but your kids, their kids, and, well, probably every generation for the next 13.8 billion years, give or take? Well, scientists at the University of Southampton in England have created nanostructured glass disks that can reportedly store data for billions of years. Now, I don't know how exactly you could possibly test that. They can say it does. But who's going to be around to test it, let alone hold them to that, right? They say they figured out how to store massive amounts of data on these small glass disks using laser writing. Lasers. Of course it's lasers. It's always lasers. Or so we've been told for decades now. The researchers there call this five-dimensional 5D digital data because in addition to the position of the data, the size and the orientation plays a role too. Now, they say that these glass storage disks can hold an amazing 360 terabytes of data each. Now, I have a lot of data, but nowhere near that much. So I'd be good for all of one disk for probably my entire life of photos. These disks are stable at temperatures up to 1832 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 1000 degrees Celsius. and they're expected to be viable for 13.8 billion years if they're stored at room temperature. Now, of course, in 13.8 billion years, the room is going to be long gone. So who cares what temperature it was? Okay, they're not all gems, but I try. Let's move on. In case you're wondering, the average house fire burns no hotter than about 1100 degrees Fahrenheit, so these disks should be able to survive that no problem. Your home may be gone, but your digital data would still be there. The university says that these disks have a, quote, virtually unlimited lifetime, end quote. So they're perfect for universities, museums, national archives, libraries, governments, etc. All of humanity's knowledge, of course, could be stored on these things, a lot of them, and they could very well outlive the human race. That is a crazy thought right there. The researchers are looking for companies that can help bring this data storage technology to market, and if the price isn't too cost prohibitive, this could help solve a lot of problems for people and help ensure that our important data and family memories live on for a long, long time to come. I think now's a good time to mention, of course, that in the meantime, make sure you're routinely backing up your data, not just your photos, but your important data, financial records, etc. And that means that having multiple copies is a good idea, and one of those should be off-site, whether you're taking a copy to the office or you're putting it in a safe deposit box once a week, once a month or so, taking it to your family member's house, whatever. Just make sure you have copies away from your house in case your house burns down, you have a flood, you get the idea. I'd like to thank you all for listening to episode 49 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Don't forget to check us out at petapixel.com/podcast for the show notes and to see what else we have for you. If you head on over there, you can leave us a voicemail question that we can answer here on the show. Or if you don't feel comfortable leaving a voicemail, feel free to email me at lensshark@gmail.com. And if you'd like to connect with me personally, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook where I'm Lensshark. That's LENSSHARK. All right, with that, I'll see you all in episode 50. Hard to believe we're halfway to 100, huh? Well, it's f8 and 250th of a second outside. Time to shoot.
Please subscribe to the Petapixel Photography Podcast. My daddy is the host.